I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Is your car fuel bill higher than last year's? How about $50,000 higher? We'll hear how the rising cost of fuel and food are affecting towns and institutions. But first, it doesn't look like things are going to get much better anytime soon. The gross domestic product is the value of the goods and services produced in the country over a year. Figures released today by the Commerce Department show that value increased just 0.6% in the last quarter. Also today, the Bush administration announced it will bring back the one-year Treasury bill to deal with the soaring deficit. And the Fed is expected to announce another rate cut today to boost spending. Nigel Gault is chief economist with Global Insight. Nigel, we were hearing this morning that if the GDP went down, it would be a terrible sign. It didn't, but it hardly went up. So what's your takeaway?
It's a very small increase, just 0.6%. And in fact, the only reason it went up at all was that firms added to their inventories of unsold goods instead of running down those inventories as they did in the fourth quarter. So when firms look at their final sales, what they sold to consumers in durable goods, non-durables, business equipment spending, and also what was spent on residential construction, they're going to see that their final sales were actually falling. And they're probably going to conclude now they've got too many inventories on hand. That means they will be likely cutting back their production.
Cutting back production means cutting jobs. It just takes the energy out of the system.
That's right. We still have all the cyclical parts of spending that we're looking at were declining in today's report.
Well, by the way, we just spoke with historian Kevin Phillips, who feels that the numbers in the GDP are cooked, that, you know, items are taken out of the goods measured. Do you think the numbers we're getting are solid, or do you think the GDP is actually worse?
Well, it's very hard to say. These numbers are subject to plenty of revision. So it could be that by the time we go through a few revisions, we'll find out that the numbers were actually worse than initially stated.
Yeah. Well, what's the significance of the Bush administration bringing back its one-year Treasury bill? First of all, how does the Treasury bill work, and what does its comeback mean?
Well, it means that the administration is having to borrow a lot more money this year than it had originally anticipated. Revenue growth is coming in slower because the economy is turning down. And, of course, they have to fund the huge stimulus package, all the checks that are going out to households right now. In order to do that, they need to borrow more money, and they've decided the best way to do that is to bring back this one-year Treasury bill in order to get the new financing.
Is it a good buy for consumers? I mean, it's guaranteed as opposed to, say, a stock.
Oh, sure. It is a good buy for consumers. It means that you'll certainly get back your principal and you'll get back some interest rates, but you may not get much interest relative to the rate of inflation right now, which is running rather higher.
And the Federal Reserve expected to lower a key interest rate today by a quarter of a percentage point following a year and a half of steady cuts, trying to get more cash in the economy. How much, though, can the Reserve keep cutting?
Well, that's a big question, and it does look like the Fed, even if it cuts today, is going to signal that there may not be that much more, if any, to come in interest rate cuts. It's concerned that interest rate cuts have been depreciating the value of the dollar, have been encouraging the boom in commodity prices, and it's a bit worried that interest rate cuts right now are becoming counterproductive for the consumer because they're ending up pushing up the price of oil, gasoline, food, etc.
How do the interest rate cuts push up other prices?
Interest rate cuts push the dollar down. Value of the dollar going down encourages people to move into commodities as an inflation hedge, and that's pushed up the price of oil and many other commodities.
Right, because people are investing in things like grain, and that drives the cost of food up.
Exactly. People are seeing no return on investing in interest-bearing assets. They're looking elsewhere. The big story right now is commodities. Those prices have been surging.
Nigel Gault, he's an economist with Global Insight in Lexington, Massachusetts, as we just keep trying to keep an eye on the economy. Nigel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, and we want to take a few minutes now to hear from people in the economic trenches. That calculus that Nigel laid out of a higher cost of oil and commodities, a declining dollar, along with less cash available for credit, means higher costs for Americans who have increasingly less money to spend. Well, one place where you might have noticed the biggest increase, as Nigel said, is the grocery store. The Labor Department is reporting that food bills overall have climbed 5% since last year, with the biggest jump jumps in staples. Milk up 26%, eggs 40%, bananas 19%, in part because of the cost of production of grain. But imagine if instead of feeding yourself or a family, you're responsible for feeding thousands of people. That's the situation Mary Angela Miller faces. Let's start with her. She's an administrative director for the Ohio State University Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio, also president of the National Society for Healthcare Food Service Management. Mary, tell us, how much is your food budget and how much has it jumped?
Well, the budget for the approximately 3,000 meals that we could serve on a typical day, we budgeted this year for $3.7 million. Where we're at compared to that is we're up about 12% right now.
Wow. And who are these people that you're serving?
Well, it's interesting. Most people don't realize that in healthcare, in addition to the patients, we actually serve more meals to our visitors and our staff and our health caregivers than we do to the patients themselves.
And what are some of the costs? I mean, we know that some of the costs of food have been driven up because of the high cost of grain. But what are your extra costs, you know, that come with serving food?
Well, one of the things that we hadn't anticipated was the additional freight costs because of gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And another impact has been we use a lot of disposable ware, and for many of those products, they use petroleum as an ingredient. Mm. And so the cost of that has increased as well.
Well, but now some people might think, well, you know, the cost of your food, you're probably just going to pass that on to the patients.
Well, the patient food cost is fixed as part of the daily room rate. So, no, we don't pass it on to patients. And we're determined as much as possible not to pass it off to our staff as well. Our goal for retail food service is to give the best, the most that we can at the lowest possible cost so that we can deliver, you know, a great value meal at a break-even price.
How are you going to make these decisions? Because as you cut costs, you can't cut corners because it is a hospital and, you know, people expect things to be healthy.
I agree with you. It's been really tough. Some of the things that we've tried to do is to really leverage our relationship with our suppliers. Because we're a big customer, we should be able to expect good service, and we build up a lot of goodwill. We almost consider our suppliers our partners. They're actually members of our professional groups as well. And now is the time that we would come to the table to them and say, okay, you know, here's our top 10 products. Tell us what else is out there that we might be able to get the best quality or similar quality with, but is there a better price opportunity?
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that we're trying to do to maintain the same level of quality without increasing costs.
You also represent about 2,000 food service professionals. So who are these people?
These are people that would be directors or leaders in healthcare food service throughout the country, but we're on staff. We're the ones employed by the hospitals, so we're most loyal and determined to deliver the best product in terms of food service to our healthcare institutions.
Well, and, you know, all confronting this problem, I would imagine. I mean, what are they saying to you about the rising costs?
It's a national concern. We try and do a number of things. One, make sure that everybody understands what's going on out there. And two, we work a lot with educating members on the numbers. Know what your cost of food is per patient day. Know what your average retail transaction. And we actually do a number of things like benchmarking so that we can compare what the typical average cost is across the nation and look at how we're doing compared to that and help you get a better feel for what the future may hold and how you could budget for that.
Mary Angela Miller, she's administrative director for the Ohio State University Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio, also president of the National Society for Healthcare Food Service Management. Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Well, global shortages of wheat and rice are one reason for some of those high food prices that she just told us about. But other grains in short supply and high demand are hops and barley, key ingredients for beer. Sam Caligioni is founder and president of Dogfish Head Craft Brewery in Milton, Delaware. Sam, give us an idea how much you've seen the prices of hops and barley rise.
Well, just to give you some perspective, our brewery focuses on brewing strong beers, so we use over four times the barley of the big breweries, and barley is our number one cost of goods, and our difference in prices from 07 to 08, our barley costs went up 62%.
Ooh, that's a lot.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult, and we didn't want to destroy our growth momentum, so we only went up $1 a case in our costs, which didn't even come close to covering our cost increase. So suffice to say, we're going to be a little tighter on profit margins in 08 than 07.
And this idea that you use more barley, is this part of being a craft brewer? What does that mean, a craft brewery?
Yep, technically. typically craft breweries are small breweries, independent breweries that brew traditional beers, meaning unlike the big breweries, we don't use corn or rice in our recipes. We use the more expensive crop of barley exclusively for fermenting. And then also, since our beers tend to be stronger in alcohol than the average, that takes a lot more barley as well, because, of course, barley is the sugar source that the yeast converts into alcohol.
Now, we know, you know, there's more demand for rice and other crops, in part because developing countries like India and China are demanding more food. Does the same apply to barley? Why is that going up?
It is. There's a lot of that, sort of the international pressures, but also even nationally, you know, with the ethanol boom and the subsidies there, a lot of farmers that were growing barley for beer are, you know, pulling out those crops and putting in new crops for the ethanol situation, so that doesn't help us either.
Right, and critics, of course, of the ethanol boom say that ethanol is not
sustainable.
A sustainable substitute for oil, and it's taken up all the corn crop, but we can see how it's taking farmers away from barley as well.
Right, right.
Well, you were at the Craft Brewers Conference in San Diego last week. Were these high costs the talk of the conference?
It was one subject. You know, frankly, we've not seen an increase like this since the craft brewing renaissance really gained traction about 20 years ago in 1 year. And it stings, I'm not going to lie. But overall, you know, beer is an affordable connoisseurship. Even with these price increases, you're only going to set gourmet lovers back about $10 a six-pack, $9 a six-pack, no more than that, really, in most cases.
Wait, hold on a second. $9 a six-pack, that's a lot.
It's a lot, but then, you know, the same consumer understands that an amazing bottle of Pinot Noir can justifiably cost three times as much as a mediocre bottle. That logic is starting to take hold in the beer world as well.
Huh. Well, so you're hoping that, you know, beer lovers and connoisseurs who know the difference between your beer and, you know, a Bud mm-hmm. will continue to pay for it. But how long can that go on?
You know, if these prices continue to rise, and to honestly, we're also facing pressure on the hop growing side, where, you know, the hop growing commercial hop growing region in America is the Pacific Northwest, and you literally have Chinese brewers showing up with suitcases of cash and knocking on growers' doors and saying, "I'll pay you four times as much for your hops if you break your contract with the little American craft breweries." So the pressures aren't isolated to the barley.
Chinese merchants with suitcases of cash.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you fight that?
You hope that your contractors stay ethical, and you hope that they honor their contracts. And more than that, you hope that they adjust their crop-growing acreage in the forward-looking years so that these, you know, naders in supply don't poke their heads in the future.
Are you planning on putting a message on the product to the consumers?
Well, no, I mean, the beer consumer today is a lot more enlightened than they were 10 or 20 years ago. And I think at the end of the day, they're willing to spend an extra buck or two to buy beer from truly small independent breweries.
He said with fingers crossed.
This is true.
That's Sam Calagione, founder and president of Dogfish Head Craft Brewery in Milton, Delaware. Sam, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thanks for giving us the time, Robin.
So to recap, Chinese businessmen are competing for ag products here in the U.S., and the rising cost of oil affects even paper plates in hospital cafeterias. Coming up, how school districts may have to cut teacher positions to pay to fuel gas tanks in the buses. And later today, the soundtrack of the seventh inning stretch hits 100. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with our look at how the economic downturn is rippling through the country. The rising price of gas is hitting just about every sector of the economy, with regular unleaded gas at a record $3.60 a gallon on average and diesel at $4.18 a gallon. Those higher prices are forcing school districts to make some tough choices. In rural Dubuque County, Iowa, where school buses cover 4,900 miles a day, diesel prices have gone up 35% this year. Bob Hitchin is Director of Transportation at Western Dubuque County Community School District. Bob, welcome.
Thank you.
And just how much have you seen your fuel bills go up? Can you give us the dollars and cents?
Well, we had to budget this year approximately $50,000 more than we did the previous year. And the way the price has been going the last few weeks, we're not sure that's going to be enough to cover us.
That's an amazing amount of money. I mean, can you give us what would that bring the total to?
Well, our budget for the year is over over $300,000.
So 50,000 more, potentially, maybe more than that. And what is that equivalent to in your county? I mean, what might that be spent on otherwise?
Well, in our district, a starting teacher's salary is less than $25,000, so you could equate that to starting teacher salaries.
And as I mentioned, this is a rural area, so, you know, how long might kids be on a school bus every day on average?
On average, they travel about 1 hour each way, so it's an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon.
So, I mean, people here where we are in Boston, you know, might have been thinking when they heard of this price hike, oh, well, they're going to have to do, as some of these school districts on the East Coast have done, have parents drive the kids. But they can't do that out there. That's too far.
No, it's really not an option. And there's so many households that have two working parents that a lot of times the parents are gone when we get there to pick up the kids.
Well, how does the county plan on making up for this shortfall?
Well, our budget is fixed. We get budgeted on a per-pupil basis through the state, so we have to make cuts in other areas to try to save enough money to pay for our fuel. We're looking at all options. We've instituted fees wherever we could legally to have students help pick up some of the cost of transportation for extracurricular events, but you can only go so far on that. So, you know, we might have to delay equipment purchases or computer purchases, so it's a struggle.
Bob, what's it been like as you've watched this number climb up?
Well, it's been kind of crazy. You keep thinking we're going to hit a ceiling and things will settle down and get back to normal, but it's just an upward climb that doesn't seem to have an end to it. We're locked into using fuel at whatever cost it is, and we're just going to have to make budget cuts to accommodate for the increase.
Bob Hinchin, Director of Transportation at Western Dubuque County Community School District. He's seen his fuel prices there shoot up 35% in the past year, $50,000 more. Bob, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Well, the rising cost of oil isn't just hurting drivers, it's hurting the roads they drive on. That's because oil is a key ingredient in asphalt, which is used to patch potholes. In the Midwest, an unusually harsh winter has sprouted a bumper crop of potholes, forcing some towns to pick and choose which roads they fix. In East St. Louis, Illinois, road repair costs nearly tripled this year to $5 million. The city can't afford that, so officials decided to only fill the deepest and largest potholes. Robert Betts is city manager. Robert, give us an idea of how much the price of asphalt has gone up for you.
I guess over a year ago, we probably got $45 a ton for asphalt, and now we're way over $55 a ton. Concrete prices have gone up as well, and just an increase is across the board.
What are some of the side effects of having to, you know, play this game of moving things around on a chessboard to see what gets done?
If we take money from one line item, it's going to affect something else. Something
right.
is going to go lacking. So we do home repair programs. We do business retention programs. We do economic development incentives to local businesses. We do youth programs for the kids. Unfortunately, a lot of those line items, most cases, will be cut. We have a very serious problem here. And East St. Louis is a very poor community with very limited resources and very limited manufacturing and very limited businesses, and we don't have the Walmarts and the Boeings and Anheuser-Busches that our surrounding communities enjoy.
Well, we understand, too, that some of these communities are seeing that they don't have as much of the gas tax to help pay for these repairs. We understand that road repairs where you are funded by the state gas tax. In neighboring Iowa, for example, the state did a study and found that people are driving less because of the high cost of fuel, and they're, in fact, using 18 million fewer gallons of gas. That costs the state about $6 million in taxes that they're losing. That's in Iowa. Are you feeling the same thing, a loss of revenue from state gas taxes?
Well, it's a little too soon to say, but we're bracing ourselves for a reduced motor fuel tax coming into the city, as well as sales tax. People are driving less and using the public transportation to try and get to and from their destinations. It's a ripple effect. It is really hurting our community.
How else is the downturn hurting East St. Louis?
Oh, the economy is just terrible. A year ago, we were having discussion with some outside developers that were interested in talking about the expanded redevelopment activity that was occurring in St. Louis, expanding over to East St. Louis. But now developers are going bankrupt, and they're closing shop, and they're not as optimistic and willing to take those risks that's involved in redeveloping a inner city that has been stricken by poverty and the loss of jobs.
We understand you were talking to these developers about rehabbing an old hotel, putting in a marina, a port, that kind of riverfront that generates so much revenue for different cities.
Absolutely. But the economy has just kind of slowed down everything. Our housing market has slowed down. People are experiencing foreclosures, and the few housing developers that we did have are there's no brick and mortar going on right now. They're pretty much shut the job sites down, and it's just a terrible time in our city.
Are you ready to declare the city's roads and infrastructure an emergency?
I am. We're positioning ourselves to request the senators and congressmen to step up and help deal with the city's infrastructure crisis that we're confronted with.
Robert Betts is city manager of East St. Louis, Illinois. Robert, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
So, how's the economy affecting you? Are you a city manager or a small business owner? Send us your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Tomorrow on Here and Now, why are so many young men from a small town in Libya becoming suicide bombers in Iraq? Well, it's in part because of a battle with Americans on the shores of Tripoli in 1804. That's tomorrow, Here and Now. With much of the presidential campaign spotlight centered on Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and Obama's former minister, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, more on that very public split in a moment, Republican John McCain isn't getting as much attention, but he's trying. This week, he's on a multi-state tour promoting his health care reform ideas. Last week, he campaigned in poor areas of the country looking for voters Republicans rarely court. He can't just sit out the rest of the primary season. Compared to the Democrats, he's short on cash, and his polling numbers aren't great. An Associated Press Ipsos poll shows Clinton opening a 9-point lead over McCain in a head-to-head matchup, and a USA Today Gallup poll shows that only 39% of Americans hold a favorable view of the Republican Party that McCain represents. Well, Jonathan Martin is senior political reporter for Politico.com. He joins us now on a shaky cell phone. But Jonathan, thank you. You've been following the McCain campaign. Frank Rich wrote in the New York Times this past Sunday that he disagrees with the conventional wisdom that McCain is benefiting from this lack of attention he's getting. Your thoughts on that?
I think it's a double-edged sword, to tell you the truth. Look, the upside for McCain is that he finished the Republican primary with very little money, next to no organization, I mean, really on a string. And this has given him a sort of grace period these past few months to get organized, raise cash, put together a staff, and start thinking about more policy ideas and start rolling some of them out. So in that sense, he has benefited. And further, I think he's been helped because the Democratic primary has exposed some of the demographic vulnerabilities of Senator Obama. Now, conversely, the Democrats, whoever they nominate, will emerge with phenomenal amounts of money. They will outraise McCain by many fold. They will have organizations on the ground in most every state in the country at a county-by-county level, and they will have registered millions and millions of new voters. Pennsylvania alone is a great example of that. So I do think that there is a sort of two sides to this story, and nobody right now can tell with any great accuracy as to if it's better for McCain or the Democrats.
Well, but Rich says McCain isn't getting vetted and tested the way the other two candidates are. They may be getting beaten up, but at least it's, you know, way ahead of November. And a lot of Democrats are waiting to address some issues with McCain. They say that he's getting a free pass on his spiritual guides. Let's address that issue. There's the Reverend Rod Parsley of the Mega World Harvest Church in Columbus, Ohio. He's called for the obliteration of Islam. He rails against homosexuality. McCain has called Parsley his spiritual guide.
Yeah, I think McCain will face more scrutiny once the general election gets here. But the fact is that, you know, folks like Frank Rich and a lot of Democrats will try and connect McCain to Parsley, also John. John Hagee, a pastor in Texas who's very controversial, who McCain sought out the endorsement of. But it's just never going to have the resonance because McCain wasn't going to that church like Obama was, right?
But let me jump in there and say, you mentioned John Hagee. This is the Texas televangelist who's called the Catholic Church the great whore and a false cult system. You know, there may not be an equivalence, but his critics, McCain's critics, would say that there's much to discuss there. He did seek out Hagee's endorsement, whereas Obama is struggling to separate himself from a spiritual leader that he had for a long time. Some would say that in McCain seeking out Hagee, you know, he was pandering.
Right. But I'm just telling you from a very realistic point of view, it's never going to have the same resonance as somebody who married Obama, baptized his children, who was his pastor for 20 years. That said, there's plenty of vulnerabilities there on McCain. I think the effort to try and create a right-like figure to tie around McCain's neck is just never going to help them because it's just not going to have the resonance. Their better bet on McCain is to paint him as a third term for one of the most unpopular presidents in the history of the country right now. That is what I think you're going to see have a lot more resonance, and that's what many smart Democrats are already trying to do right now, is connect McCain and George W. Bush on both the economy and the war, both of which right now, as you well know, are not viewed fondly upon by the American people.
Well, you know, let's tie it all up with a ribbon then, because staying again with the spiritual guides, McCain once called evangelists Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell agents of intolerance. And we remember in 2006 when he went and practically prostrated himself before Falwell. The same with President Bush. He had a very public fight with Bush over terrorism and the use of torture. And then seemed, you know, to acquiesce to President Bush. That kind of, as you said, relationship with President Bush tying into the war, it really seems to sort of cancel out his maverick reputation.
Well, you nailed it. I mean, that is exactly the case that Democrats will make, is that McCain talks a good game about trying to be somebody who bucks his own party, but when it comes down to it on core issues, is a conventional conservative and is no different than George W. Bush. McCain, conversely, I think especially as we get closer and closer to November, is going to try and distance himself from Bush and the party. He's going to talk about issues like global warming. He's going to mention the fact that his party let spending get out of control. And I think it's, you know, those kind of issues where he will try and, in the words of Bill Clinton, find a third way to set himself apart from his own party, but also Democrats. Whether or not that is something that he can pull off while not unduly angering the base of his party that is already skeptical about him is an open question.
Yeah. Well, this week McCain has put out some plans. He's got a health care plan in which he wants people to be able to buy more of their own insurance as opposed to having companies provide it. He's moderated his stance on the housing crisis. He says the federal government can step in and guarantee risky mortgages. Just tell us a little bit more about, you know, what he's saying and how it's being received.
Sure. Well, McCain is trying to roll out some policy ideas right now to get in on that news cycle, try and get some attention during this Democratic primary. He has rolled out this week a plan on health care. It's pretty conventional conservative stuff, market-based. He wants to try and empower consumers, give them a tax credit to purchase their own health insurance. Critics, a lot of people say on the left, and also health care scholars say that's just not realistic. This is a broken down system. This is classic McCain trying to find a balancing act between conventional conservative dogma, but also doing something about the economy, about health care, both of which most Americans view now as broken. So he's sort of trying to find his way, but he's helped it to a certain degree because not many folks are paying attention to him right now.
Jonathan Martin, senior political reporter for Politico.com. By the way, there's a book coming out in a month about McCain's, he even describes it as a legendary temper. You've discounted the book, but it's going to be out there. What about those personal quirks, personal stories? Are those kinds of things going to be in the headlines as much as they are for the Democratic candidates?
Oh, absolutely. If this election is about issues and about the direction of the country, McCain's going to have a tough time winning. If it's about matters of character, McCain's got a better shot. That said, McCain does have some challenges when it comes to character, namely his temper, which he even admits himself is very, very fiery. Anecdotes about his temper will persist. John McCain is somebody been in politics, been in public life for a long time, and when you are around as long as he's been, you're going to have enemies, and those folks, you can be sure that will come out during the course of this campaign.
Jonathan Martin, senior political reporter for Politico.com, on his cell phone on the McCain trail. Jonathan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, John McCain is at a town hall meeting in Allentown, Pennsylvania today. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Senator Barack Obama is also on the campaign trail today after breaking with his longtime pastor yesterday. Obama's denunciation of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright came after a string of appearances by Wright. So what happens now? Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News and author of The Note at abcnews.com. Rick, this has just been an extraordinary story. You say Obama is seeking a message as he tries to put the Reverend Wright behind him. What is that message, and does Obama have time?
Well, he needs to have time. He can't just be talking defensively about Reverend Wright and why he doesn't agree with him. He has made a major shift in tone just in the last 2 days between first saying that he couldn't really distance himself from Reverend Wright or disown him, and now saying that he really needed to just set the record straight. Now he needs to make a little bit of a turn, make this about issues that voters care about. Say, look, we're beyond this now, and this is why I'm the best candidate to address gas prices or jobs or the economy or health care. Make it about something other than Reverend Wright. This has been a massive distraction for him at a bad time for the campaign.
Well, what do you think happened here at the end of the arc of this story? As you write, Wright's reemergence was wacky, weird, wondrous. It started off Friday night in that appealing talk with Bill Moyers. Wright explained that the phrase, chickens come home to roost, was actually spoken by the ambassador to Iraq. He was quoting him, that a government conspiracy to spread AIDS was actually a fear of a congregant, and all Wright said was that the American government was capable of that given that they'd infected black men with syphilis in the Tuskegee experiments. Then on Sunday night in Detroit, he was charismatic. What happened by Sunday morning when, in the question and answer at the press club in D.C., he was reckless and destructive?
By Monday, I think it had a lot to do with the audience at the National Press Club. It wasn't just journalists. A lot of them were his allies in the clergy, other supporters of him personally, and it got he got fired up about it. And this combative press conference he had where he was just indignant in explaining some of his answers, it drew a lot of negative coverage, and it didn't really do him any credit. And it became clear, and I think one of the critical things that he said was that, look, Barack Obama didn't really distance himself from me. The implication there was that Barack Obama, actually believes what I'm saying or doesn't disagree with what I'm saying. He's just doing it for political reasons. That is extremely damaging. It's one thing, I think, from Obama's perspective, to watch Reverend Wright talk about his personal beliefs, but it's another thing to suggest that he shares those beliefs with Barack Obama.
And he was clearly angry yesterday when he spoke, and in this break with Wright. How is that going to affect African-American voters who may see him as throwing his pastor over the side of the ship, and working in middle class and white voters who may be saying, why didn't you do this years ago?
I think there's a bit of a risk of alienating some black voters, but at this point, we're seeing 80-20, 90-10 type of margins. It's hard to imagine that's going to change based on this. I do think that this does raise a lot of questions, though, continued about why he maintained this relationship, why he didn't make clear his disagreements with Reverend Wright 6 weeks ago. The substance of what Reverend Wright is saying in terms of some of the things you reference about the government's responsibility in 9/11 and the possibility of implanting AIDS and even his respect for Louis Farrakhan, these things have been known for quite some time. Senator Obama tried to be very careful in the way he distanced himself, though, 6 weeks ago. Something obviously changed since then. Reverend Wright's reemergence had everything to do with that. I think if Reverend Wright had not come back, we wouldn't be talking about this story today, and Senator Obama wouldn't have to be playing defense right now.
Where do you think this goes down, Rick, in sort of the annals? You know, it seems like an extraordinary personal story, in addition to being a political one, you know, that we're all watching.
It is, and it's one of those moments. I had this thought watching the press conference that Senator Obama gave. This is one of those just turning point moments. It's not often that you can pinpoint it at the time and say, this is a critical moment. We don't know what direction it's going to go. I think it's going to have a lot to do with what the voters in Indiana and North Carolina say about it on Tuesday. But it's key that Senator Obama is facing now the biggest challenge to his candidacy yet. He is at a point where he needs to prove his appeals to the white working class voters out there. Superdelegates are concerned about that. Otherwise, this race would already be over. So he's going to have to make this case affirmatively. And the voters, I think, in the next round of states will render some of that judgment.
And do you think, as Richard Wolff of Newsweek has speculated, that Barack Obama may actually quit the church? Do you have a thought on that?
I don't feel like he's under that kind of pressure, and I do think that would raise different questions for him. If he were now to say, look, I'm no longer a member of Trinity, I think that's when you really start to risk a backlash. It does look like he throws his old church, not just the pastor, but his whole church under the bus.
Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News, author of ABCnews.com's The Note. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up, take me out to the ball game, please, in 1 minute, here and now. Question, what does this song, this version is from Al Jolson, have to do with baseball?
Oh, shine on, harvest moon, up in the sky.
Well, nothing, except that the Tin Pan Alley hit Shine on, Harvest Moon was written by Jack Norworth, who also co-wrote this.
Take me out to the ball game, take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back.
Everybody sing. Take Me Out to the Ball Game celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. It's the third most sung song in America behind Happy Birthday and the Star-Spangled Banner. And joining us with the complete and official history of this seventh-inning musical icon is Tim Wiles. He's director of research at the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, and co-author of a terrific new book, Baseball's Greatest Hit, the story of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Who knew it was such a complex story? Tim, welcome.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Well, and right off the bat, we have controversy, because apparently Take Me Out to the Ball Game was written in 1908. Jack Norworth reportedly wrote the lyrics. Albert von Tilzer wrote the music, although there was some question about whether one wrote both. But there's also dispute as to whether or not any had been to a ball game before they wrote the song. What's the real story?
Well, Albert von Tilzer and Jack Norworth both claimed that they had never been to a big league ball game before they wrote this song. And Albert von Tilzer is probably correct in that assumption. But we think Jack had been to a ball game, and that's where he got the color for the situation. And we dug that up in a 1953 gossip column where he dropped a few date clues and reminisced about having seen McGraw's Giants at the Polo Grounds. And he said, you know, the next year I wrote an umpire's song, but it wasn't as popular as Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Well, the one and only song he ever wrote about umpires, Let's Get the Umpire's Goat, was written in 1909.
Uh-huh.
So we think we've got him at a ball game in 1908.
You say he wrote the lyrics on a scrap of paper riding the train, inspired by a billboard for the Polo Grounds. And there's a sort of a preface to the song that we know, an introduction about Katie Casey.
Absolutely. You know, most people don't realize there are two verses that go along with the familiar chorus. Katie Casey was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad, are the first two lines of the
mm-hmm.
song. So she was really asking her boyfriend not to take her to any of the standard date venues, but to take her out to a ball game.
Right. And what's interesting is that when this song became a hit, which it did, it was a hit in movie theaters first.
Yes. Movie promoters in that era really could only afford one projector. So when they had to change the reel on the movie, they had 4 or 5 minutes of dead time. So they did kind of the most primitive music videos that we could think of. They did these glass illustrations that were projected one at a time up on the screen, and then the lyrics would be under the image. And, of course, then they were singing with a live pianist, so we had sound in the theater as well, even though these were the days of silent movies.
And this explains why today we sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game when we are already there.
Absolutely. It's one of those Zen koans that goes around the Internet.
Well, how did it become this seventh-inning stretch song?
Well, you know, the custom of pairing this song with the seventh-inning stretch is such a perfect baseball custom that most people assume that it goes a lot further back, perhaps all the way back to 1908. But it really wasn't until 1976, when Hall of Famer Bill Veeck owned the Chicago White Sox, that he asked the colorful announcer Harry Carey if he could mic him. Harry was in the habit of singing the song to a couple of rows of fans right outside of the broadcaster's booth. And Harry wanted nothing to do with it. He said, no thanks, Bill, I'm just going to keep doing my thing. So Bill said, well, you know what, I already taped you, so if you don't sing live, I'm going to play this tape. So the reluctant Harry Carey did his star turn in 1976. And since that, pretty much every major league team and every minor league team has picked up the seventh inning stretch custom.
Let me hear you. A 1, a 2, a 3. Take me out to the ball game. Well, it's been parodied. The co-writer, Jack Norworth, added a new heroine, Nellie Kelly. Let's listen, by the way, to a parody from Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen has his version, but here's a parody. Now, there's some 400 musicians who have recorded versions. LL Cool J, the Boston Pops, Jerry Lee Lewis, Andre Previn, Liberace, Bob Dylan. You listen to hundreds to choose 16 to make it on the CD that comes with your book. We understand this is your least favorite. Let's listen. Okay, no offense to David Weiss, who plays the musical Saw. enough of that. But another version that you say is the strangest was the 1930s, 40s vocal group, the Ink Spots. Let's listen.
That's right. I'm going to root. I'm going to root. Root for that home team. Now, if they don't win, boy, that's going to be a shame. See? Because it's one, two, three strikes, you out at the old ball game.
Take me out to the ball game.
Okay, Tim, what did you think when you heard this?
Well, how ethereal, how spooky, how spacey, kind of prefiguring the 60s a little bit. They've really kind of taken themselves out to the ballgame, you might kind of say. They're having a great time, but they are definitely in a class by themselves or in a league of their own, you could say.
World of their own.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just a personal aside, did you come across the James Gang's one-syllable off version?
We came across three different one-syllable off versions. I'm not sure if we had the James Gang. That sounds like fun. I'd like to hear that.
May I?
Sure. Yeah.
Because I tell you, this started a whole, you know, skill for me that I carry to this day. Me out to the ball game, take me out to the park, buy me some peanuts and cracker jacks. I don't care if I never get back, for it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame, for it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Robin, that is just fantastic.
Well, what do you think, Tim? I mean, you're telling me there were many versions of the one syllable off?
There are three or four. In fact, I'm told it's a standard music school thing that people need to learn the one syllable off or the one note off version as a way of just kind of getting their own vocal chops down and being able to follow words and melody as separate tracks in their mind. Because they are two different things.
Tim, do you think we're going to be singing it 100 years from now? I mean, what do you think the durability is?
I think that because it's 100 years old, and, you know, it's actually more famous today than when it was written 100 years ago, and I think in 2108, a radio interviewer from Boston is going to be talking to someone from Cooperstown who's written another book on the second 100 years of the song.
Tim Wiles, Director of Research at the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, co-author of the new book, Baseball's Greatest Hit, the story of the song Take Me Out to the Ball Game. For more, go to our website, here-now.org, and let's go out with what we understand is your favorite version.
Absolutely. This has that baseball swing. It's the great Dr. John with Swamp Boogie version.
Take me out to the ball game.
Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and cracker jacks. I don't care if I never go back. Go to the root, 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 but I'm home.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.